Contained herein are the heresies of Radolf Burntwine, erstwhile monk-turned-traveling medical investigator. Join me as I uncover the blasphemous truth of a plague-ridden world, that ours is not a loving God, and we are not its favored children. The heresies of Radolf Burntwine, coming January 2nd, wherever podcasts are available.
You're listening to Muses and Stuff. This is the podcast that's all about the dolls. They were the groupies, the wives, the girlfriends, and the muses who played such a huge role in rock and roll history by simply being themselves.
They were sweet, sexy, brave, and powerful. They went after what and who they wanted, and they made no apologies.
We are your hosts, Shanti and Lynx.
Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the show.
Hello.
Hello, hello. I'm sitting here with Lynx, and she just started off with a banger. She just told me an amazing story. I'm wearing a Father John Misty shirt right now.
It's a great shirt. I love it.
She told me the story about this time a woman got on stage with Father John Misty and tried to take a selfie with him.
During Board in the USA,
and so he's all into it, emotional, and she gets up and I was sitting here with like my mouth like, what?
Yeah, you're saying there's a time and a place for a photograph. When a performer's on stage giving it their all is definitely not one of them. And then she wouldn't
get off the stage. He finally relented and stood there for a moment, paused the entire song so we could all, you know, let her have this moment, and then she just continued on.
I was at a show last week at the Mod Club, the Alalas, this band from LA, and two people got on stage during their set.
And we're just like hanging out up there?
Okay. I have not seen, or maybe I was really looking for it, but I saw every single kind of groupie you could ever imagine at that show that night. Every kind.
They're always there.
The ones that were backstage, the ones that were at the front of the stage, the young boy groupie. Mm-hmm. So that was one of the guys that got up on stage.
Oh, yeah.
Just crawled right up, took the tambourine right out of the lead singer's hand.
That's ballsy.
And then went and started playing tambourine with like a couple of the other
well, that's
band
fun.
Members.
That's fun. I mean, depending on the band, that can either be great or not. But jumping up solely to take a selfie is rude.
Okay, so listen to this one. And then there was the woman that got up and tried to take over the microphone. Yeah. So she got up, and this is not the first time I've seen this happen either. No. And I'm sure people listening to this, it's not the first time, like, that I'm sure you've seen it.
Absolutely.
Somebody somehow gets up on stage, security is just doing whatever security is doing, and the woman gets up on stage and she starts just like belting into the microphone, and then she does exactly what you think she would do after that. She crowd surfs to a group of people that were just like not ready.
No, like, not that type of crowd. You got to pick those moments. You know, it's all about perfect timing.
They did their best to hold her up, I guess.
And
yeah, and then there were these beautiful women who were sitting at the front of the stage, like before the Alalas went on, but they were really interested in the band before that because they were from Australia. So I have this beautiful picture of them like leaning up into the stage as the guy is leaning forward, and I'm just like, if people think that this like groupie culture does not exist,
you haven't been to a show, you haven't opened your eyes.
Just watch. Yeah. Just look around.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Which one are you?
Which one am I? Oh God, I think I've been all.
I wasn't asking you. I was asking the audience. But if you want to, the listeners. But if you want to answer that, Lynx, you can.
Well, I think I've been all of them probably, except the selfie taker on stage. That's a little much. But I have been invited to take over the mic before. Mm-hmm. And I've sung along, but always with permission.
good.
Yeah.
I ended up getting backstage at that show, at the Mod Club without a pass. And so that can still happen. But that's another story for another time. Welcome to Muses and Stuff.
Yes.
Welcome. We've got another amazing, just amazing, if I do say so myself, episode for you. And it's right after we did the male muses, the boy in the song, we're doing the girl in the song.
Yeah, giving the ladies a moment to shine as well.
Yeah. And how did we narrow it down to 10? You're probably asking yourself. We're not asking yourself.
Well, once again, just like with the boy in the song, we're trying to choose ones that are lesser known and none of the major muses, people who deserve their own episode, they'll get their own episode. These are just, again, like 5-minute tales. Just some little tidbits for some awesome songs.
Cool. So before we get into that, let's do groupie good news.
Yeah.
I was going to say for the week, but really it's the day because it just happened today.
This is exciting.
You can tell them.
No, you go for it.
Okay. So I believe you informed me. So you sent me a message today telling me that Brian Ray, who is Paul McCartney's guitarist, is following us on Twitter now.
Yes. And he's also in the Bayonets.
He's also in the Bayonets. And we know it is for sure him because he's got that little blue
check
mark. Because what we're noticing, too, is a lot of people that are starting to follow us, we have to look in to see if it's really them or not. Because there's this weird, I don't know if you guys know this, but there's this weird thing on the internet where people pretend to be celebrities.
It's an interesting form of fandom.
Yeah, that's an interesting form of fandom where they have an account that just says, like, Marianne Faithful.
Yeah.
And then they just post
and there pictures. Are the type who, you know, will post like right under that, I'm not Marianne Faithful, mm-hmm. like this is me pretending. But there are others who want people to believe that's the case. Those are the interesting ones, I think.
Yeah, or there's like these accounts that are just like rock and roll dedicated. So they'll post pictures of like the Beatles or Led Zeppelin, but then the caption won't be like explaining anything about that photo or that band, but it'll just be like the person's personal, like, I don't know, like whatever they're going through that day. Just like, oh, I don't want to do my homework.
Yeah. Like, there's a lot of fans and groupies out there doing their own thing online.
Yeah.
Cool. You just gotta be careful with some of the imposters.
Mm-hmm.
It's cool if you let everyone know you're not real.
Just let us know if you're real or not, okay? I want real love, baby. Ooh, don't keep me waiting. So, speaking of not real, Brian Ray is not real. So he's real. Yeah. And this is, I'm going to share you his Twitter bio. So it says, singer/songwriter, producer, lead rhythm and bass guitar with Paul McCartney, at Bayonets, and then reluctant rock god. New single out now.
That's such a strange addition there. Why so reluctant?
Brian, why are you so reluctant?
You're
playing
answers.
With Paul McCartney. You're a rock god, okay?
Reluctant. I think it's like everyone wants to be a rock star.
Don't treat me differently because I am now Paul's
guitarist.
Right-hand man.
Yes. Well,
I'm just a regular guy in the Bayonets. Brian, we're not making fun of you.
No.
Although Lynx and I were discussing earlier that people need to have a little bit of a sense of humor about rock and roll.
Absolutely.
People are just a little bit too serious with it all.
We need to go back to the lighter days.
We need to go back to Frank Zappa in pigtails wearing a dress with Jimi Hendrix just like chilling out beside him.
It's interesting because like even like Kurt Cobain and Nirvana and like they did fun shoots like that where they were like dressed up like women and... You know, they had a sense of humor about themselves. What's happened in the past 5 or so, 10 years, that bands seem to have lost some of that.
Not Andrew WK.
No, he's He's still partying.
That guy's always up for a party.
He's the best.
At least I like to think.
He's the best.
Andrew WK, we're going to check in on you. We want to know, you still partying?
I'm going to guess the answer is yes.
Okay.
All right.
Let's get into the first song. You are going to tell me the song lengths.
Yes.
Because it is I, Shanti, who is now speaking. And you're starting off with a song that I do not know what it's about. I only know from the incredible music sequence, the bus scene.
Everyone.
Of everybody's favorite movie. No, not everybody, but...
a lot of people. If you're listening to this, you probably love that film.
Yeah. Yeah, it's Almost Famous, guys. It's Tiny Dancer.
Yes.
Lynx, take it away.
All right. So when seamstress Maxine Fiebelman joined Elton John's tour, she wasn't expecting to find herself a muse or a wife, but destiny awaited her.
Ooh.
Yes.
Good start. I'm in.
Once a trained dancer, Maxine would spend shows side stage, dancing freely, enjoying the tunes. It wasn't long before she caught the eye of Elton John's songwriting partner, Bernie Taupin. Sorry about that, Bernie. Who found himself smitten and penned this loving tribute in 1970. In 1971, 21-year-old Bernie married Maxine. They only lasted 5 years. Reportedly, Bernie just loved the rock and roll lifestyle a little too much.
Mm.
But Maxine also served as muse for the song I Feel Like a Bullet in the Gun of Robert Ford, which is about their split. And she also came up with the title of The Bitch Is Back, the Elton John song.
Yeah.
Apparently, Elton would have his days, and when he did... yeah. Maxine would turn to Bernie and go, uh-oh, the bitch is back.
Elton, straight up bitch.
But Elton knew, I mean, he loved it. So it was all right.
All right. Cool.
Yes.
Tiny Dancer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's interesting.
You know what? I just remembered this. One of my favorite things, Dave Grohl has ever done, and you know how we both love Foo Fighters and Dave Grohl.
Yes.
He sang Tiny Dancer on like Letterman or something.
Really?
And he was just whispering into the mic that he really just wanted to recreate that scene from Almost Famous. But the song went on and on and on and on and on because he didn't know how to end it. He didn't know how to finish it. He just kept going on and on and on with it. And I had it on like a mix CD that I listened to on my way to high school every morning.
Does it feel like it goes on and on?
Yeah. Yeah.
That song made such a perfect scene in that film. It's just one of the greatest uses of a song in a movie.
Yeah. I just made the connection this week because the last 2 weeks I've really been connecting with a lot more of the dolls, of the groupie dolls in the group that like I haven't talked to, and just reaching out to them and being like, what's up? What's your deal?
Yeah.
What are you
what's
up
going
to?
On with you?
What have you been up to? Who have you been up to? And they're all really great and receptive. And now I have them on Facebook and a couple of them are doing really great things, going to London, all these kind of things. Mm-hmm. And I had posted a picture of BB Buell and somebody was like, man, I really thought that was like a scene out of Almost Famous. Because there's a picture of BB
Buell.
Oh,
yeah, with
Buell
the bus.
And the bus.
The beautiful coat.
Oh, totally.
Yeah.
And that's it. It's like Penny Lane is these women. Mm. But for a lot of people who've seen, say, Almost Famous, Penny Lane is real.
Yeah.
She is as real as BB Buell and Pamela Debar. And it's wild how they took all of these women, Michelle Overman.
Yeah.
And
put her together.
Put her into this like beloved character.
Yeah. I highly, highly recommend seeing the director's cut for anyone who hasn't and who loves that film, because there's so much more of Penny and she's way more well-rounded a character because of that.
Yeah. My turn?
Yeah.
Okay.
Go for it.
So I'm going to be telling you the story of Sweet Caroline.
Ba, ba, ba.
Ba, ba, ba. By Neil Diamond. Which, yeah, I mean, Cracklin' Rosie is my personal Neil Diamond song.
Oh, okay.
But, you know, I didn't know the story of Sweet Caroline before this. The only beef I have with this song, which really doesn't have anything to do with Neil Diamond, is a couple of times, I guess when I was at university, I would go... I'd go out dancing to not bands, but just like a 90s night. Or,
yeah.
Now, the Neil Diamond is 90s night, but a 90s night or a retro night or whatever. Yeah. And you know at those bars where they play the things, but then they cut the music and then it's just the crowd? So they do with Bon Jovi's, oh, we're halfway there. Cut it.
Yeah.
And then it's just the crowd going, ah, wah.
Yeah.
Or, they don't. They probably do it with Journey's "Don't Stop Believing." They do it with "Sweet Caroline." Sweet Caroline.
And then the
cut the music, and then everybody bop bop bop. Okay, but the worst part is "Good Times Never Seem So Good," and then people start going "So good, so good, so good." Did you never hear that?
No,
drives me crazy.
I've never heard that. Where was this?
Everywhere. Peterborough, Halifax. That's really the only places I've ever been.
No, I think I in Toronto they're too cool to do that.
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah.
So the story, this Caroline woman, this mystery woman, was revealed in 2007. And she was inspired, or Neil Diamond was inspired by a photo of a young woman on the cover of Life magazine in 1962. The caption under the photo was, "On her pony macaroni."
Aww.
Adorable. If I had a pony, 100% I'd name it Macaroni. He said, "It was such an innocent, wonderful picture. I immediately felt like there was a song there." And it ended up being President John F. Kennedy's daughter, Caroline Kennedy. So it wasn't until Neil Diamond went through a divorce in 1969 and he had two young daughters, he wrote this song, which took him about an hour, everything in. And the reason why it didn't come out until 2007 is because he wanted Caroline to be the first one to know that it was about her. And so he told her at her 50th birthday party.
That's so sweet. What a gift.
Yeah.
And like to go all those years, no doubt people constantly singing it at her. I mean, everyone who's named Caroline probably gets annoyed with that song at some point in their life.
Yeah.
I bet you, she probably had many moments with that song before ever finding out that it was about her.
Yeah, it is definitely a gift. I remember one time a musician gave me the literal gift of a song, and then he handed it to me because he was coming in from out of town, and he handed me, it was a 7-inch,
mm-hmm.
and he was just like, "There you go.
Aww.
It's a song about love." And then we like broke up that day. I think it was like that last time, but yeah, it was a gift. It was nice. It was sweet.
The first time a guy ever wrote me a song, we had sort of been flirting, I guess, for a while, but I wasn't really interested. And then I finally agreed to go on a date with him, and then he picked me up at my place and he handed me his iPod, and he had recorded like that day this little song, and he was like, "I wrote this for you," and it was really adorable.
Aww.
Yeah.
And knowing Lynx guys, it was like a really famous band, because I'm just like getting these stories from her, and she's just you wait, babies, but you're gonna have to pay for that.
all right, so the next one, just get off topic there.
Shut up, Shanti.
Have you said all you needed to about Caroline?
I'm done.
All right, so the next one comes from Anthony Kiedis's autobiography, Scar Tissue.
I heard that book sucked.
No, it's so good.
Really?
It is so good. It's one of my favorite rock and roll memoirs, actually. And I have had friends who've read it who aren't even into them, and they also loved it. I'm not like a massive Chili Pepper fan myself, but it's a good one. So you've been told.
Okay, Lynx.
So he talks about meeting Sinead O'Connor in 1989 at a music festival. "I was dying a million deaths watching her," he said. After the show, Sinead and the band hung out before her manager came to scoot her away. Worried he'd never see her again, Ketus wrote her a love letter and gave it to her as she left. It wasn't until over a year later, when Sinead had moved to L.A., that the pair had met again. One look at her and my heart just melted. I would have married her on the spot. The two started casually hanging out, dinner dates, movies, museums. He even hung out with her son. He called it the most wonderful non-sexual relationship he's ever had. But Ketus was smitten and wanted more. I adored her. Every day I'd wake up and I'd write her a little poem and I'd fax it to her.
So love nice. Fax. Well, yeah. It's better than that damn Facebook Messenger.
I guess the fax was the early 90s Facebook Send Messenger.
Send me a fax any day.
So everything was progressing beautifully until the day that Ketus called and Sinead abruptly told him she was leaving L.A. and didn't want any more contact with him. Going from, I can't wait to see you, to don't call or come by was a terrible blow for Ketus, and he turned to his bandmate John Frusciante for comfort.
He's the smart one, right?
He's the beautiful one. John suggested Ketus write a song, and the pair stayed up all night to record it. Ketus dropped the tape off at Sinead's before she left. The pair did meet once more years later at an MTV event. Ketus called the meeting the most horrible, awkward, poisonous, communicationless exchange.
Been there.
What does Sinead have to say about all this? I've never had a relationship with him ever. I hung out with him a few times, and the row we had was because he suggested we might become involved. I don't give a shit about the song he wrote.
Ouch.
Ooh.
That's pretty harsh.
Like, good for her, though.
But there is a happy ending with Akita's song.
Yeah. Let me tell you right now. So, a little side note. Another muse who served as muse is what I wrote.
Sure. Another singer.
Whatever. Another singer who served as muse to Ketus was, get this, Mel C from the Spice Girls.
That's right.
And you're like, whoa, Sporty Spice? Yes, Sporty Spice. You would probably think it was Scary Spice, like I did. I was like, which one is that? Scary, definitely, right? And Lynx was like, no, Sporty. Okay. The pair had met and struck up a friendship the first time the Spice Girls were in L.A., and they kept in touch. So he wrote the song Emmett Ramis about her, which, my friends, is summertime spelled backwards. Mm-hmm. Now, how... Yeah, I was going to say, like,
how clever
and poetic. But we've got some, like, real poets coming up that we're talking about, so I'm not even going to... Really. Yeah, she was definitely more flattered than Sinead was, mm-hmm. And she actually said that it was the most romantic thing that anyone had done for her.
That's sweet.
Do you like the song?
Yeah.
Lynx don't like the song.
It's all right. It's not one of their best, but... It's cute.
Okay. All right. Oh, it's my turn again. Okay, fantastic. So now we're going to move on to...
More modern.
A more modern song. And it's Mac DeMarco. So we've been having... we had Agnes DeMarco, Mac's mom, on the podcast, and she's amazing.
Hey, Agnes.
Hi, Agnes. And we've been in touch with her, and we're going to have kind of a, like, what's up, Agnes segment in the spring, but it's going to be video-based. So, yeah, we have that coming up. And we've been thinking about Mac's muse, Kira.
Mm-hmm.
So her name's Kira McNally, and they've been together since they were 14 years old.
That's so impressive.
Yeah. Yeah. I heard that, yeah, they were at a party when they were 14. No, I didn't hear it. I read it in a Pitchfork article where she just, like, walked up to him, like, kind of drunk at a party when they were young, and was like, I love you, you know.
Aww.
And I guess it's been, like, they've been together.
And he was like, I love you too.
Yeah. So there's three songs specifically on the Salad Days record that mm-hmm. are called the Kira songs. And so one for sure is Let My Baby Stay. And, like, just listen to some of these lyrics. I was made to love her, been working at it half my life. I've been an addict. And she's been good to me. Far as I can tell, she's happy living with her Mackie. Oh, so please cute. Don't take my love away. Let my baby stay. Please don't take my love away. Let my baby stay. And where would I be, feeling lonely, separated from my one and only? And what's there left to say? Far as I can tell, that day could be on its way. So please don't take my love away. Let my baby stay.
That's so adorable.
Like, that is some, like, that is poetry.
Yeah.
Mac DeMarco, the guy who, like, used to, or I don't know if he still does, like, stick things in his ass on stage. Like, fucking poetry. Some beautiful
shit, yeah.
Totally. So I'd say, like, probably the other songs might be Let Her Go. And so I put, like, Mac DeMarco, Let Her Go lyrics into Google. And then I'm, like, reading. And I'm like, whoa, these ones are, like, even more, not intense, but it's, like, I really didn't expect, like, this from him. Mm-hmm. And then I just, like, look up and I was reading the lyrics to Adele's Send My Love to Your Ex-Lover.
How did those get mixed up?
I have no idea. So this song, Let My Baby Stay, is, he says, it's essentially about Kira being an illegal immigrant in America, because we know that they live in Brooklyn. Okay. Her ability to enter and exit the States is threatened, so that's a stress for me. And it's pretty much all my fault. So, yeah, he was saying it's hard being on tour 10 months with a few breaks. Sometimes they've gone 90 days without seeing each other. They live in a tiny place together, but it's essentially like being in a long-distance relationship. Mm-hmm. It's not easy dating a musician. It's really not.
I kind of like that they go away for a while.
Yeah.
But that's just my preference.
No, I get that too. And I do like that too, because I like my alone time and my independence, and you get to miss them and things like that. Yeah,
some relationships are different. Theirs is obviously a very close one.
I think maybe it's just kind of hard to date a musician in general.
Oh yeah, for sure.
That's
why if you expect anything like lasting, you might end up hurt. It should be about fun.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Let's not go down the sad no. rabbit hole of all of the reasons we shouldn't date musicians. Yeah. I'm retired. Like, nice try.
Yeah.
No matter what you do, it's like,
it's always there.
Yeah. I don't even do it on purpose now. It's like, I'm not even, it's just, there it is. So one thing that I found that was pretty interesting, like reading up about Kira, is seeing like how many followers she has online. And it does say in the article that, you know, there's lots of pictures and videos of them online. So people start to get interested when musicians are dating people, male, female, whatever. Mm-hmm. He says it's fucking weird that a relationship's so public. And I can't just objectify Kira as this lovey-dovey thing to sell my records. But she's all like, oh, it's reality, man. But I mean, like, throwback to the shirt that I'm wearing of Father John Misty's, you know, I Love You, Honey Bear.
Mm.
The girls are like, if you need to do it, then you do it.
Yeah.
Sometimes you have to.
How can every rock star has. Every rock star has a muse that's inspired them.
Yeah. I was reading up about B.B. Buell inspiring Elvis Costello with the Blood and Chocolate record, which is apparently because every time she had her period, she'd want chocolate, and he was so mad at her after she aborted their child, or made the decision to abort their child, or unborn, you know, whatever mm-hmm. we want to call it. He pretty much denies that, like, Get Happy or anything yeah. else had, like, that she had any kind of influence. But she was saying, like,
they had a deep relationship.
He was even interested in what kind of mascara I was wearing. Yeah. Like, he was so interested in everything that I was doing. It sounded like a pretty intense affair. But so the article that I found that on, and if you want to know more about Bibi's relationship with Elvis, you can go and listen to that episode that is about her and, you know, Mick Jagger, Steven Tyler, all that. But this article in particular, just I to refresh my memory, called her book deliciously trashy, and they called her self-obsessed.
They do that for, like, all of the women.
What is up all with that? Them. Why are all of these guys, like, saying, like, oh, like, I even had, yeah, I don't know if I want to say it this way, but somebody said she would go, not talking about BB, talking about somebody else, she'd definitely go on your podcast because she loves to talk about herself. And it's like, okay, but then can we say that the musicians that are getting up on stage, like,
exactly.
Well, yeah.
And is everyone?
Because they love hearing their own voice. Or they, like, come on.
Is everyone who writes a memoir self-obsessed? Like,
well, probably, but if we're gonna sort of chastise one person with this autobiography, exactly, and calling themselves obsessed, yeah, then like, what about all of these other autobiographies that I'm turning to, mm-hmm, on my shelf that are by, you know,
exactly, it's ridiculous.
I mean, I guess they are, yeah. So there's Mick Fleetwood's, you know, autobiography. Is he self-obsessed? Probably, but is anybody giving him shit for it?
And
no.
If there's a good story there and they want to tell it, like, how is that harming you? Like, why do you have to write on
guys,
someone?
Guys, just chill. Okay?
I feel like some musicians, maybe this is Elvis is this way, they feel like if they say that someone helped inspire a song, a woman, whatever, that it somehow lessens their talent. Like, they're afraid it'll take away from them to admit that other people influence them.
Mm-hmm.
It's a strange thing. Because there's been many musicians who support the women that they've been with in what they do later on in life. But there are others who try to run away, and Elvis is a good example. Like, they had a pretty intense relationship, and all artists absorb what's around them. Mm-hmm. Like, it makes sense. And to, like, not even want to admit that, like, Blood and Chocolate was somehow influenced by her, it seems kind of silly.
Yeah, totally.
All right.
Your turn.
All right.
You're up.
So, this one is a fun one. Well, it's a folk one.
A what?
A folk.
Folk.
A folk.
Okay, let's hear it.
So, the next song, Sweet Judy Blue Eyes, that's Sweet, S-U-I-T-E, by Crosby, Stills, and Nash. So, when Stephen Stills and Judy Collins got together, she was 5 years his senior and had just released her 7th LP.
Hi-yo.
He served as guitarist for her 8th album in 68 before him and David Crosby began jamming. And in the summer of 68, Graham Nash joined them at a party hosted by Joni Mitchell in the canyon.
Oh, I would give anything to be at that
Can
party.
Can you imagine? And the trio, like, blew everyone away, and they became Crosby, Stills, and Nash with their beautiful harmonies. So, with both of them at the height of their game, their relationship began to buckle, and that gave Stills endless material. It poured out of me over many months and filled several notebooks. I had a hell of a time getting the music to fit. Judy thought the song was beautiful and was present for the recording of it in late 1968. The following year, the pair split, unfortunately. She left him for actor Stacy Keach. On the version they recorded for their first album, Stephen plays all of the instruments himself, like it was too precious a song for anyone else to touch.
Let me do it.
And in 71, during a Rolling Stone interview, I think the interviewer said something about Judy and her being a muse for multiple songs of his. And Stephen said, "There are three things men can do with women: love them, suffer for them, or turn them into literature. I've had my share of success and failure at all three."
Hmm.
Judy would go on to record over 40 albums, She wrote novels and memoirs and was appointed a Goodwill ambassador in 95. The pair are
then
still...
Then why does nobody know about her?
I know, right? She's sort of like a forgotten folk woman.
No kidding.
She was like at the head of like all these protests during that area. She did a lot. She was a figurehead for, you know...
Well, we should post a picture of her.
We will. That's a good idea. So the pair are still on
it's
very good terms.
The least we can do.
Yes. Judy says, he wove all that together in this magnificent creation, so the legacy of our relationship is certainly in that song.
Nice.
Yeah. Yeah, they're another beautiful folk couple. Like Joni.
Ugh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, Joni gets her dues, but Judy doesn't.
Mm-hmm. It's true.
Very strange.
Well, speaking of Judy, she's going to show up in my next one.
Really?
Yeah. So I'm doing Suzanne by Leonard Cohen.
Mm-hmm.
And man, I think everybody's got to know about Suzanne by now. I think she's probably one of the most famous music muses. I love Leonard Cohen.
Oh, God, me too.
I'm more of a Leonard Cohen poetry groupie than anything. Like, I for sure listened to
Absolutely.
His records,
Absolutely.
But there were, like, years where I would just be on the bus or just, like, sitting by the river or, like, sitting under a tree, and I would just... Ugh.
It's one of my big music regrets that I never got to see him live.
Yeah.
I've been praying that he would come play at Massey Hall or something like that, like a nice venue. But
yeah,
unfortunately, he passed.
Well, Suzanne met him in the 1960s, and she was a teenager. He was in his late 20s, and he first saw her at Le Vieux Moulin Jazz Club in Montreal. So... she was dancing with her lover and husband-to-be, who is a sculptor named Armand de Villancourt. So if you can just probably picture Leonard Cohen sitting there watching her. Mm-hmm. Sitting, watching her dance. Romantic, creepy. If it wasn't Leonard Cohen, I don't know what to tell you. But it was Leonard Cohen, so...
So it's okay.
So it was okay. Apparently, according to the book that we read, she was the muse to many beat poets.
Mm.
So I don't know, maybe you just have that quality that you just become a muse to beat poets.
Charisma.
Yeah, it's something.
Something.
I don't know what, because I cannot say that I am a muse to any beat poets yet. I'm still young.
Are any of you out there?
In 1965, she went through a separation and she went to live with her daughter. And that's when Mr. Cohen started visiting. Mm. And I guess he was really kind of inspired by the crooked floors and the poetic view of the river from her home. So he'd go over and... they'd light a candle, serve tea, and sit in silence.
That's beautiful.
Yeah. There's something on my yoga studio the other day up on the wall, and it was something like, you know, true communication happens in silence, something like that. And so then after they got their little bit of silence out of the way, they talked about what else? Life and poetry.
Of course.
Mm-hmm. So it was a true meeting of the minds, not bodies, regardless that Leonard Cohen was smitten. So that's when lines such as, you've touched her perfect body.
Mm-hmm.
You've touched her perfect body with your mind. And Suzanne was the woman who was... literally feeding him tea and oranges. That's what they would do. And so the poem from The Parasites of Heaven, 1966, Suzanne Brings You Down, he'd written that, and Judy Collins recorded it.
Oh, yeah, that's right. That's right.
Yeah.
Before Leonard did.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then he got a record deal.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, like Hallelujah came out then kind of around there. And Leonard Cohen, I like this, established as the thinking woman's favorite. Goddamn right.
That's interesting.
Yep. Yeah, so she was very much very much a like kind of hippie woman. She would wear like rags and feathers from the Salvation Army counters, and yeah, like they, I think they remained friends, but that was it. I think it was kind of an unrequited love type of deal.
Well, that's really beautiful.
It is, yeah, it is. But, I mean, man, like, I love Leonard Cohen, and I think he was, you know, beautiful poet, attractive man. Like,
absolutely.
What are you going to, why do you say no to that?
I don't know. I couldn't tell you.
Yeah.
There's one woman who couldn't say no to Leonard Cohen.
Who?
Once. Janis Joplin.
What?
Yes. So in the late 60s...
Genuine surprise. Like, I'm...
You're going to like this.
Okay,
then.
Let's hear it.
So the both of them had been living at the Chelsea Hotel for a while in New York. And as we know, the Chelsea served many poets, many musicians. And in 71, Cohen penned this as a eulogy to Janis, the song Chelsea Hotel Number 2.
No, I didn't know that.
Yeah. So the legend has it the pair met in the elevator, and Janis had been trying to hook up with Kris Kristofferson unsuccessfully. I don't want to say permanently unsuccessful, but at the time unsuccessful. And she bumped into Cohen, and as he says in the song, "You told me again you'd prefer handsome men, but for me you'd make the exception."
Ooh.
Yes. Yeah. So their affair was very brief and relatively meaningless for both of them. And Cohen has since regretted admitting that she served as a muse. I think because lots of people assume they must have had something deeper than just like a one night stand.
Mm-hmm.
And he didn't really know her that well, or they certainly didn't have like a real relationship. So he calls it the sole indiscretion of my professional life.
Oh, wow.
Admitting that it's about her. Yeah.
Okay.
It's a beautiful and sad and I think fitting tribute to Janis.
Oh. Yeah. Wow. Okay.
I love the Chelsea Hotel. And another interesting little tidbit, there encounter happened in room 104, and then about a decade later in room 100, that's where Nancy Spungen was murdered by Sid.
Oh shit.
Yeah,
that is a little tidbit
just down the hall.
I feel like I should give a little tidbit now. Okay, I'll give you a tidbit. It doesn't have anything to do with those numbers or those people, but it's a Tom Petty.
It's of a little course
Tom
it
Petty
is.
Tidbit. You got to get it in. So, do you know the song by Stevie Nicks called "Edge of 17"?
Of course.
Do you guys know that song?
Of course.
Edge is that the white winged dove.
Sings a song.
Okay, so "Edge of 17." Do you know what that means?
I just assume the obvious, but tell me.
Okay, so The reason why it was named Edge of 17 was because when the song was being written, Stevie Nicks was having a conversation with the then wife of Tom Petty, and she asked them when they met, and she said at the age of 17, but because her southern accent was so strong, it sounded like Edge of 17, and so that's why she, that's where that line comes from.
That's interesting. Yeah. I did not know that.
Mm-hmm.
That's cool.
Cool.
Cool. So the next song, I love this song. It's another one that's really well known in a movie.
Boo 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 doo 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 doo.
Yes. So that would be My Sharona by The Knack.
What movie?
It was in Reality Bites when they're in the
oh yeah.
And they're dancing in the convenience store at the gas station. And it's also the opening track in the new Richard Linklater film, Everybody Wants Some.
Okay.
And so when 25-year-old Doug Figer met 16-year-old Sharona Alperin, he immediately fell head over heels.
He was how old?
25.
Okay. Not going to touch that one. Yep. Let's move on.
Sharona, however, was already in a relationship and wasn't interested, so Doug did the only sensible thing a musician can do, and he wrote a song.
Yeah.
So Figer didn't merely play it for Sharona. He invited her to the studio while the band was recording it and then asked her to be on the cover art for the single.
What'd she say?
Hell yeah.
As she should.
Yes. Needless to say, it worked like a charm. And soon Sharona was touring with the band and falling head over heels for him as well. So the song was a big hit, making Sharona somewhat of a celebrity herself. She says, people were very excited when they met me. I remember going on tour and seeing people dressed up. I'd ask, what are you dressed as? And they would say, Sharona's.
Aww. Yes.
Their romantic relationship lasted about 4 years, with Sharona inspiring many other songs by The Knack, including You Gotta Be There. The pair remained very good friends until Doug's passing in 2010. And Sharona is a real estate agent now in L.A. She says she looks back on it all with a loving fondness and that no matter how many times she hears the song, she never gets sick of it.
No.
No.
We should go high five her when we're in L.A.
Absolutely.
Hey, Sharona.
And yeah, come look on. Up the cover art. That's Sharona. And I believe Miss P was actually really good friends with Doug Figer. Should ask.
We should ask her how he pronounces his last name.
Yeah. We hope it's Figer. Figer.
Feegs.
Yeah.
Dougie.
And there is that line in the song about going for the younger kind.
Yeah. So Jimmy Page, we're looking at you.
We're looking at all of you musicians from that era. Yeah, Steven Tyler, David Bowie.
This coming from a girl who was...
What? I don't know what you're talking about.
Okay, is it my turn?
Yeah, it's your turn.
All right. Okay, this is a song that if you tell me that you don't like it, I'm going to call bullshit on that, right? I'm going to say, you're a goddamn liar.
That's very strong.
No. Okay, it's Wonderwall by Oasis. And even if you don't like it now, like, you liked it when it came out. Or when it comes on, you're not disappointed. But it's you're not going to be the person who puts it on at a party.
It's a 90s classic.
But it's a 90s classic. I just got a text message from my dad. I texted him, let him know that Paul McCartney's guitar player now follows us on Twitter. He replied, wow. He's impressed.
We're impressed.
It's great. So this song, Wonderwall, is about a woman named Meg Matthews. So it's funny because they added this little detail in the book, but that she was introduced to Noel Gallagher in 1994 by her flatmate, who was an MTV Europe host.
All right.
So like a
VJ?
VJ. Yeah. Which, if I didn't have the career that I was in now and this podcast, I feel like VJ would have been...
I remember, like, in my teen years, I definitely, you know, considered that.
The Zappa Kids became VJs.
Oh, yeah?
A couple of them.
VJs were bigger back when, you know, MTV actually played music.
I think they're still big in
Europe.
Britain.
And,
yeah, I think that's, like, still
maybe they
a
still
thing.
Play music there.
Like, it's funny because a lot of times I'm like, ooh, who's Russell Brand dating? Or, like, who are they? And a lot of the times it's, like, MTV hosts or, like, yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah. It's the cool girl talking about music with a microphone.
Yeah.
So apparently the first time Meg met Noel, she thought that he was a miserable wanker.
Everyone thinks that of the Gallagher brothers.
Yeah. He was then, at the time, living with the Smiths guitarist. And they moved in with one another 2 weeks after they met.
Wow. Fast love.
Ooh, how romantic. Or insane.
Yeah.
It could really go both ways. Like,
it is both. It's
romance,
probably both at the same time.
Insanity, one in the same.
Yeah.
yeah, apparently, and then where they lived, like, Bono would just drop in. It's like Bono and Noel Gallagher were friends? All right, I guess. So her impact on him was immediate. She was in charge of his social diary and changed his, like, style and clothing. So she seems like a pretty cool chick, besides wanting to, like, change him completely. It's good. The influence is good. Like, my sister-in-law dresses my brother, and he's a better man for it.
A lot of rock stars get dressed by their girlfriends.
Well, fuck yeah. Yeah. Mm. And they are better rock stars, and they are better for it. It's, like, it's essential. I love it when I have, like, one of my guys come over, and he's just, like, in my closet. How about it? So born in Guernsey, raised in Durban, South Africa, she attended a boarding school and then moved to London at age 19, which is like a lot of these women lived in places that were not the United States or Europe and then went to boarding schools and then moved to London. And it gives them this like super weird story in history, which is, I think, ultimately fascinating to these musicians, too. She ran a DJ booking agency, and I don't even know why I added in that detail, but okay. Wonderwall was released in 1995, a year after they met, and he was all like, it's about my girlfriend, because she had just lost her job and didn't have any money and all the rest of it. Okay. And like some of these women that we talked about, she became kind of famous from being his girlfriend.
Of course, you know, yes. Oasis were really big then.
Yeah. Like, who are they dating? And sometimes, like, I'm interested in, like, who is this person dating? Like, I want to know what kind of, like, the other day I looked up, like, Sidney Crosby's wife. Holy shit. That makes sense. Yeah, they were regulars in the tabloid press. Meg had a reputation as a party girl, and she was hanging out with Kate Moss.
Yeah, it was a big party crowd back then.
They were buds. And so she said being like thrust into the spot like that was difficult. But she loved every minute of it.
Of course.
She did have a great time. So, but anyways, their marriage, they got married in Vegas in 97. They divorced in 2001. She went to rehab in 2006, as sometimes some of our muses need to do. Because we know, you know, there's things going on in rock and roll. There's connections between rock and roll and magic. And there's connections between rock and roll and
drugs. Well, I'm glad she got help.
Yeah. And now she's like into health and fitness.
Nice.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah. So that brings me to my surprise, my surprise song for you, because as soon as I saw that she was hanging out with Kate Moss, I was like, oh my God, the song, What Katie Did.
Yeah. The Baby Shambles?
Yeah. Okay. So I was in university when Kate Moss and Pete, do you say Doherty or Doherty?
I say Doherty.
Doherty. So I'll just go with that for, you know, it's just we're on the same page here. They were dating when I was in, say, university. Mm-hmm. And my roommate, best friend Corey at the time, she loved him too. Like, we were obsessed with him. But then we were also kind of into the relationship. And we, like, they had posted videos of themselves, like, where he was just sitting in a room with a guitar and singing. And she's, like, in this beautiful room. On this like hammock swing, right? Like, I don't know if those videos still exist, but we were interested in like what they were doing. So did you know that that song, What Katie Did, actually isn't about Kate Moss?
No.
Okay, good. I wanted to surprise you with that. It's not about Kate Moss. It's about his other girlfriend before her, named Katie Lewis.
I guess that makes sense. It's not spelled the same.
Well, that's where I'm going to get you again, because, yeah, he left the Libertines, he formed Baby Shambles, and then released What Katie, What Katie Did. Or was that the Libertines? Anyways, when he was with Baby Shambles, he released What Katie Did Next. That one's about Kate Moss.
Ah.
So, What Katie Did is a song about him doing heroin. You know, when he goes, I can feel it going down and I know that it won't take long or whatever. And it won't take none too long. It's about doing the heroin and that there was nothing she could do about it. And he recorded it in that early 60s style, shoop, 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 de-lang-a-lang, shoop, shoop, which then was a bit of a throw to shoop, shoop, it's in his kiss. And there's a mention of Mrs. Brown, Mrs. Brown, you've got a lovely daughter, and it was done with a bit of irony. So he was playing around with a few things here. Not only that, what Katie did is in, it's a children's book that was written in 1872. Mm-hmm. So That I Didn't Know by Susan Coolidge. And that follows the adventures of a 12-year-old American girl named Katie Carr. So she was a tall and untidy tomboy wishing to be beautiful and beloved. And I know in his book of poetry, in his diaries, The Books of Albion, he has a poem about a boy being very, untidy. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so a terrible accident makes her an invalid and her illness and four-year recovery gradually teach her to be good and kind, which is, like, what she wanted. So I really like that, and I really like the idea of, like, Pete being a poet, Leonard Cohen being a poet, Mac DeMarco is a poet. You know, it was nice. It was a bit of a nice theme, like, with all of those, with these guys. And, yeah, I loved reading, like, Pete's diaries, and total poet, for sure. And I remember one time, I was seeing a musician and when I was living in Peterborough, and when he left, he wrote me a little letter and he put it in that book. So yeah, it was just a little, little love note left in that book, and I found it later, and it was a nice little kind of all around full circle bit of a romantic experience.
Yeah, that's interesting. I knew about him and Kate. I did not realize that first one wasn't about her. I always thought it was.
Yeah, that's, I know.
Cool. That's cool.
Yeah, and it's nice to, like, be able to talk about. I think I was reading a lot of his, like, poetry and his journals and stuff, like, right around the time I was getting into Leonard Cohen. And, you know, if there's anything I can say, we're talking like, oh, that's, like, it's kind of a pain in the ass sometimes to date musicians and whatever. But honestly, I've had so many romantic mm-hmm. encounters and situations and letters and songs and stuff that, even though, yeah, there's, like, pain in the ass moments, it's things like this that kind of make it worth
absolutely. And I guess I didn't mean it to sound like dating is bad. I just, rock star marriages tend not to last, and I've never, like, wanted that as an end goal. That's yeah. not really something I ever think about. It's more just about, you know, meeting people, having fun, and, like, having relationships with people. But, yeah. I guess I'm not big on marriage in general, though. Mm.
Hmm. All right.
Well, I've told you this before, I think. I have one of Pete Doherty's acoustic guitars.
Oh, okay. So that bears repeating. Lynx owns
yes.
one of Pete Doherty's acoustic guitars.
Yes.
How the hell even?
I got it like a decade ago. An ex-boyfriend of mine, who's also a musician, went to school with Pete. And it was through him that I ended up acquiring the guitar.
And he gave it to you.
Yes.
He gave it to you personally. To so me. You were in the same room, breathing it the same wonderful. Air, just like around him. What did he smell like?
He was a junkie then, so.
Probably not the best question to ask.
Yeah.
Was he still like adorable though?
Oh God, yes.
Yeah?
Absolutely.
Oh, man. So yeah, you got his guitar. That's insane. Mm-hmm. I'm going to go over your house and touch it.
I still play it. I love it. It's my favorite guitar I own.
Yeah, no kidding. Really
beautiful. It's like from the 1920s. It's lovely.
Oh, damn. Okay.
So I got one.
All right, let's finish off last with this banger. Little,
yeah. We've done an episode on Merry and Faithful already. Our first one together.
Mm-hmm. Oh, man.
We were so focused, or I was, on Marion's story that I forgot to add in this little piece of trivia that's really cute. So in 1964, Alan Clark from the Hollies penned the song Carrie Ann.
Hey, Carrie Ann.
Exactly. About Marion Faithful.
The reason why I have to sing it is because, one, we don't want to edit the actual songs, and two, my music supervisor friend says we're not allowed to put music in. No, she didn't actually say that. But if I did ask, That's what she would tell me, probably.
I thought you just wanted to share your voice.
Mm-mm. No, I'm doing this for you guys. Okay. So I love you.
So it wasn't until 2007 that Clark came forward and revealed this. He says he was too shy at the time to use her real name, but I suspect it may also have to do with the fact that he was married when they had their affair.
Oh, yeah, 100%.
Yeah. But another cute song inspired by Marianne.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Weren't the Hollies, they, like, a lot of groupies have stories about them. Yeah, they loved groupies.
In Marianne's book, she said something like, marriage would never affect someone's reasoning on should they or should they not sleep with someone. Mm-hmm. Like back in the 60s, it would, like, that would, you'd be square if you took that to thought. You know, you just, if it felt right, you did it. And I guess maybe Alan Clark also thought that way.
Yeah. Hmm. Okay. So that wraps up our girl in the song. And if you're like, wait, guys, why didn't you even talk about Layla? That's like the biggest Muse song of all time. Episode one. I started off with the real banger.
Exactly.
Patty Boyd, episode one. Go for it. Or
and all the ones you think that we've missed, you'll be seeing their episodes come up eventually.
Yeah. Catherine James, Wild World. That was covered. Cat
Stevens.
You mean
Patty Darbinville.
Patty Darbinville. Yeah, no. That's what I meant. Catherine James is Dr. My Eyes.
Mm.
Don't worry. We're going to get to lots more of these women. Like, I'm telling them not to worry. He's like listening like, nobody's worried. Okay, good. Well, we hope that you enjoyed this episode and that you learned some new rock and roll trivia.
Yeah, and coming up, we got a great Miss P episode. And we have our friend Mickey, who's the number one psychic.
Yeah.
Celebrity psychic, I believe.
Yeah. She was on E-Talk recently. Yeah. She's got a bunch of books.
You've probably
seen her.
She's
the real deal, guys. She is the shit.
Yeah.
She's really cool.
She's got such a great backstory.
Oh, yeah. Like, let me just say carnivals and magic.
Yeah.
So we're really excited to bring you that. And then we're going to have a really super special guest.
Super special,
the next coming weeks, too, which
cannot
we're really excited about.
To
it'll be an interview. So that's it for now. Thank you to everybody who's listening and who's...
And I'll make a playlist and we'll put it up on Spotify. Remember, we're there now. Just look up Muses and Stuff. And happy listening.
Yeah, happy listening to that. I think this is going to be a great one. You can follow us on Twitter at Shantine Links. I mean, if Paul McCartney's guitar player does,
Why aren't you?
Probably should too. You can find us on Instagram at Muses and Stuff Podcast, on Facebook, Muses and Stuff, same thing. Rate, review, subscribe on iTunes, all that great stuff. And just keep being amazing. And just like next time you go to a rock show, just like look around.
Yeah.
Let us know what you think.
Mm.
But have fun.
Absolutely.
Always have fun.
Absolutely.
Always have fun. We love you.
Till next time.
Are you thinking about getting into Dungeons & Dragons? Maybe you're looking to expand your horizons as a DM or a player. If that's the case, then it's time for you to check out The Dungeon Cast, the best D&D podcast out there that helps you passively learn all about the game just by listening. Join co-hosts Will and Brian as they break down the lore of a rich multiverse 50 years in the making in a lighthearted and beginner-friendly way. They cover everything from character creation options to tips for dungeon masters. There's something for everyone, no matter how long you've been playing TTRPGs. Get inspired while learning all about the unique planes of existence. Get the in-depth knowledge you need to help your combat encounters feel impactful, or learn about the origins and pantheons of every race and class the game offers. No stone is left unturned as every edition of the game is explored and explained in a way that benefits players of all different levels of experience. You can expand your TTRPG horizons in a way that's as entertaining as it is educational just by listening. All you have to do is go to your favorite podcast app or YouTube and search for The Dungeon Cast.